used to them. Fortunately, at least this week I've been wondering. In such times. And there's been a Buddha who's lived, who's taught the Dharma, and there's still a lineage of teachings coming from the Buddha down to us. And we also have the benefit of so many practitioners' experience on the path, and they're having unpacked the teachings for us and shared with us how they went about approaching the teachings. So it's kind of like having ready-made clothes, not just cotton on the bush, but it's been made into cloth and sewn to fit our size. And somehow, miraculously, we've created the karma to meet the teachings. And then also from our own side to have faith in them, to have interest in them, to have a spiritual yearning, which again in this consumer society where materialistic values are supreme, having that kind of wish is not so common. So having that yearning and then being able to meet the teachings, those two things coming together, also very rare. And then being able to take time out and really plunge into the teachings and explore them and practice them and have not only the material wherewithal but the support of like-minded friends and having books and having teachers. And when you think of all the conditions that had to come together for us to be able to practice, it's really quite astounding, quite miraculous. And so to appreciate that and let that really gladden our heart and fill our heart with joy. And so in that way direct our mind towards the most noble aim of full enlightenment, and do so with that gladdened heart and with a mind that cares about other living beings, with a mind that really deeply wants to transcend our own self-centeredness. And let's listen with that kind of attitude. So there's one verse in the Guru Puja, and it's also, I think, in Shantideva and Nagarjuna, that says that the self-centered thought is the source of suffering. And when we compare the happiness of us limited beings who cherish the self-centered thought, who hold on to it, as if it's our best friend, and we compare our happiness with the happiness of the Buddhas who have relinquished that self-centered thought, then it's rather astounding to see the difference. Yeah. 'Cause we hold on to the self-centeredness, thinking that it's going to protect us and it's going to bring us happiness. And the more I think about me and get my needs fulfilled and do what I want and have what I want, the happier I'm going to be. And yet, the Buddhas who have given up all that way of thinking are zillions of times happier than we are. Yeah. And they have the mind that cherishes others. And when we think of cherishing others more than ourselves, we get really kind of jittery. It's like, if I cherish others more than myself, what's going to happen to me? Who's going to take care of me? Oh, I'm going to be lost. I'm going to be neglected. What's going to happen to me? And does your mind get like that? Yeah, my mind gets like that. And then it's so funny, isn't it? How that very mind that is so afraid for me is the mind that's causing us suffering. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that mind that cherishes others more than self, that we're so afraid of having, is the mind that brings happiness. So, you know, when you really look at that, then you can see how terribly confused we are. You know? How confused the afflicted mind is that it thinks that the causes of happiness bring suffering and the causes of suffering will bring happiness. And how much work we have to do again and again and again, you know, going over this and checking our mind and examining our own experience to continually convince ourselves that it's actually the opposite of what we think it is. Yeah? And the only way to do that is just continually reminding ourselves. You know? And then again, you know, each time just looking at our own life and our own experience and seeing how that mind that's so self-preoccupied and self-critical and down on ourselves and afraid from the selves and lonely and unappreciated and unloved and trampled on and all those terrible things, that mind itself is the mind that's making us miserable. Yeah? True or not true?
True.
Yeah?
True.
You know, I mean, I it's just amazing when we get stuck in our pity party. It seems like the pity party is true, and we need something from the outside to come and save us. And yet, that very mental state is the one that's making us so miserable. Yeah? In the same way, when we get angry, we think, my anger is going to protect me. And yet, our anger is what makes us vulnerable. What do you think? Does your anger make you vulnerable? How does it make you vulnerable?
You're just totally like a little porcupine. I mean, anytime somebody even looks at you funny, you're already... So the vulnerability is, since you're expecting all that to solve out there, anything that comes at you, the slightest skew or different than it is just... pokes at you and just gets it going.
Yeah. So it makes us vulnerable in the sense that we become so super sensitive. Yeah. And then, of course, when we're angry and we lash out at others, then the anger makes us vulnerable because others are going to reciprocate. Yeah. Nobody's going to take our porcupine quills and say, oh, thank you so much. You shot me with your porcupine quills. I really like that. No, they're going to, like, throw them back. And that's going to make us more unhappy. And yet, you know, anger seems like it's looking out for us, but it's not. It's doing the exact opposite. So when you look at that situation, then we really have to have some compassion for ourselves, don't we? And some compassion for other living beings, because we're all so really terribly confused. And how can you despise somebody who's confused? Yeah, they're doing the best they can. Okay. So we've been talking about the Bodhisattva practice, you know, in chapter 5, we're on now, and you know how the bodhisattvas really have that sensitivity to other sentient beings and want them to be happy, and how they're able to really extend themselves to make them that others happy, and how they experience so much joy themselves. Yeah. It always, they give this example a lot in this text, in the text, and it never fails to impress me, that when a bodhisattva hears somebody say, "Please help me," or "Give me this," a bodhisattva feels incredible delight, like super happy. And I just think about, you know, I get an email and it's starting off, you know, "I would like to ask you a favor," and my mind instantly goes, "Oh, what now?" Yeah? And how just I have the total opposite reaction as a bodhisattva, and yet, and I'm miserable, and a bodhisattva is joyful. Yeah? And my mind automatically goes, "Oh, what now? How can I get out of doing some for this person? You know, okay, I want to do my own things, and they're asking me, and Whereas a bodhisattva just hears, you know, "Please help me," or "Please give this or that to me," and it's like, "Yes, what can I do? Please tell me." They're like wide open and so happy. Yeah? So somehow training our mind to be like that. Yeah? Letting our mind be happy. Putting down what we're doing and saying, "Wow, you know, I have the possibility to benefit. Isn't that fantastic? I don't always have the ability or the chance to be a benefit. But here's somebody wanting some help. Yeah, so now I can do something." Just like a bodhisattva, when, you know, somebody wants something, it's like, "Finally, there's somebody I can give something to. I can practice generosity." Or when they have somebody swearing at them or throwing things at them, then the bodhisattva show up. "Now I can practice fortitude. This is great. You know, all these nice people around me, I can't practice fortitude at all. My time is getting wasted. Yeah? I need somebody to, you know, to practice fortitude with so that I can really go ahead on the path." And, "Oh, finally, you called me a name. Thank you so much. Now I can practice patience and fortitude and, you know, renew my compassion." Oh. It'd be nice to be like that, wouldn't it? Yeah. So we kind of have to practice. We have to practice. "Oh, some disagreeable person. Fantastic. Somebody who needs, who, you know, who wants my energy and needs one of my possessions. Oh, this is great." You know? And just to train the mind like that. Because, you know, at some level, I don't know, I think that mind's there in us anyway. Because my experience with young children is young children really want to help. They really want to help. Because they see that when they help, then they're part of something. And they see the benefit that comes immediately to them from joining in and helping is that then they're part of something. You know, they're connected to other living beings. And I think that's what all of us really want, you know. And we do want to, you know, somewhere in there, we do want to help. But somewhere, you know, we learn to be more self-centered than we initially were and thought, "Oh, this is a headache," instead of, "Oh, good." Yeah? Interesting, isn't it? Because you see, I mean, little kids spontaneously, they are thrilled when an adult asks them to help. And it's only because I think they see adults going, oh, I don't want to do this, that then they learn to, you know, see it as a nuisance. Did you find that when you were teaching school?
Oh, yeah. Especially the kids that were the most challenging.
Yeah.
When they got a chance to be helpful, they just went for it. And
yep.
They were happy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And their self-image of themselves being the bad person just then.
Just disappeared, yeah. So especially the kids who could be difficult, when you gave them the chance to help, and they could feel, oh, I get to help. I get to be part of something. I get to be appreciated. Yeah. Then they saw the benefit for themselves. And, of course, they saw somebody else being happy and, you know, knew that they had the power to do that, that they weren't just able to make people miserable. So it did change their self-image a lot. Okay, so we're on verse 113. So we're talking about, this verse is talking about the effect of strong compassion. Okay, so when the strength of compassion is thoroughly developed, those who cannot be trained are rare. So Aryadeva says, just as for an experienced physician, a sickness that cannot be cured is rare. Once bodhisattvas have found their strength, those they cannot train are extremely few. Okay. So just as if you have a very skillful doctor, the doctor will find a way, you know, can find a way to cure most patients. I mean, this isn't a blanket statement because there's the patient's karma, and there's also aging, sickness, and death. So it's not promising cures for everything. But, you know, a skilled doctor will, you know, be able to benefit so many people, and they're not stumped, you know, or giving wrong diagnoses or wrong medicine or whatever. And so, too, a bodhisattva who has well developed the capacity for maturing sentient beings, then it's very easy for them to be able to benefit all those sentient beings. Okay? So this bodhisattva has to have had very deep compassion. They need wisdom, you know, wisdom that knows how. You know, well, wisdom that knows reality, okay? But also the wisdom that comes with skillful means that knows exactly how to benefit somebody, you know? A wisdom, a sensitivity that knows who's attracted to, let's say, you know, the Mahayana path, who's attracted to the fundamental vehicle path, yeah? Who's attracted to compassion? And who's attracted to wisdom, you know? Who likes to meditate and who would rather study, you know? And that, so the bodhisattva is sensitive to the capacities of different people and also to the weaknesses of different people, knowing what parts they need to really build up. And so because the bodhisattva has these kind of skillful means, and doesn't shy away from helping through a lack of compassion, and has the wisdom necessary to lead others, then, you know, those that they cannot lead are extremely few. Okay? And so these bodhisattvas are very skilled in what's called the four ways of gathering disciples. So this is four ways, you know, that they are able to connect with others, that they build connections with others, I should say. Four ways of building connections with others so that they can lead others on the path. Okay, so the first thing they do is they're generous, and they give material aid. So clearly, you know, if you want to benefit somebody and you can tell, you know, what kind of aptitude they have and so on, the first way to make a connection with somebody is to be generous and to give them something, you know, because everybody likes receiving gifts. Yeah? So it's a way of making connection. And then people feel good. They feel drawn to you. Yeah? Then second thing you do is you speak pleasantly. Because again, if we're able to speak in a pleasant way to others, and we're friendly and we're kind and we're helpful, then again, people are drawn to us. So, you know, if you're a bodhisattva and you want to draw people to you so you can benefit them, then, you know, giving things material, and being a pleasant person and speaking nicely, pointing out their good qualities, having a sense of humor, you know, things like this. Okay, it's a way of drawing people to you. And then the third is you give them encouragement and you lead them on the virtuous path by teaching them the Dharma. Okay, so this is kind of the next step. Then you give them teachings. And, you know, that's, of course, the most important way. But without making that initial connection and establishing some trust, you know, if you just start right away with the teachings, they may not, you know, continue. Okay? But this way they feel, you encourage them, you teach them the path, and then you act congruently. Yeah, you live the teachings by your example. So these four things are really necessary to benefit others. You know, like if we're really stingy, then, you know, others are going to go, well, what are they going to teach me? And if instead of speaking pleasantly, we're critical and we're sarcastic and we ridicule people, again, you know, they're not going to come around. And then instead of encouraging them and giving them the teachings, if all we do is, you know, tell them they're idiots and discourage them, no way to benefit them. Yeah. And then even if we do the beneficial things, we do teach them, if we ourselves act the opposite way, then it becomes very, very confusing for the students. And then the students themselves say, well, they're teaching this, but they're doing that, so why should I follow their teachings, you know? I mean, people, we learn more by examples, don't we? Which is why my parents always said, do what I say, not what I do. But this is saying, you know, do what you say you're doing so that others will, you know, will be encouraged and they'll learn the proper way. Okay? Then, so you can see that if a bodhisattva is well trained and has these and can practice these four ways of gathering disciples, then they can train so many different kinds of people and communicate with different kinds of people. And if you ever watch some of the teachers, how they are with others, how they connect with people in a really genuine way. I mean, it's astounding. I just have a few images in my mind from some special times. One was at one of the Mind and Life conferences with His Holiness, and there was one scientist who, in my humble opinion, was anything but humble. And he, I mean, just so full of himself. And also, in my opinion, a bit too chumsy with His Holiness, not showing enough respect. But His Holiness, you know, saw this guy, because, you know, they've been together over 7 conferences. And His Holiness just was so warm to him. And, you know, the scientist comes up and just kind of like wants to hug His Holiness. Holiness is fine. And to your happiness always. But His Holiness is fine and so warm and welcoming, and you know, and I was thinking, you are so full of yourself, you know, kind of stepping out in front of everybody else, you know, before everybody else is greeted as Holiness and showing off like that. Yeah. So you can understand why His Holiness is better able to influence sentient beings than I am, you know, because I'm full of this judgmental mind. But, you know, it just really struck me. Yeah. And then one time, I think I've told you about Tsoka Rinpoche, when there were some Chinese nuns that were there, and Rinpoche had invited us for lunch, and it, you know, it's not every day you get to see Rinpoche because he's so terribly busy. And especially to be invited for a meal, and I was really pleased for my friends to have that time. And we had no sooner sat down than Sam the Second. Yeah. You have to read Working with Anger to know who Sam is. Okay. So Sam the Second, also one of these macho Italian monks, just opened the door and walked in the room, you know, uninvited. And there had been a big meeting going on of the organization. And he just walks in the room and says, Rinpoche, I was at that meeting and these, you know, people were just not appreciating me and telling me that I did this and this and this. And, you know, he was really upset because some other people criticized him. And I was sitting there going, I know why they criticized you. I know why. And Rinpoche just sat there and listened and was so kind to him and so supportive. And Sam the Second stayed there talking to Rinpoche while the food came, while we ate. And by the time Sam left, the meal was over. Rinpoche had this next thing to do, and we didn't have any time to talk with him. And Rinpoche, again, was so warm and so kind to this person, you know. I think that was my teaching, you know. Rinpoche tends to teach me by example because I'm quite, you know, thick-headed sometimes. But, yeah. So this way, sometimes, of being kind, that's truly remarkable. Or a way of being patient. Yeah. Because the Tibetan teachers, you know, they don't really have Q&A sessions. They're used to just giving a talk. And then that's it. Maybe they'll do some debate about something, but they're not used to being bombarded with a lot of questions, especially ones from Westerners, which are never the kinds of questions that Tibetans would ask. Yeah, we ask totally different kind of questions. And just, you know, seeing, again, their patience with some of our questions. Yeah. Again, truly remarkable. Okay. So, yeah, there's a lot to do when we've tamed our own mind, or that we can do. Then verse 114 talks about the faults of not giving encouragement for others' benefit. Okay? So Aryadeva says, if some within a bodhisattva sphere lacking encouragement go to bad rebirths, that one will be criticized by others with intelligence. So if somebody who's within the sphere of influence of a certain bodhisattva lacks encouragement, that bodhisattva doesn't give them encouragement, and so as a result that person gets born in the lower realms, then all the other bodhisattvas will criticize that bodhisattva. Okay? So this doesn't mean that just having a bodhisattva teach you or give you encouragement is going to ensure that you're not going to go to a bad rebirth. That's not the meaning of the verse, okay? Because clearly we need to practice. It isn't just a question of being in their sphere of influence. Okay, so for some reason, if a bodhisattva, if some of their disciples lacks encouragement, and for that reason, you know, creates negative karma and goes to a bad rebirth, then that bodhisattva's promise to benefit all sentient beings has been damaged. You know, they haven't been able to carry out that promise. And so the wise bodhisattvas will then criticize this bodhisattva. Now, of course, I don't think the wise bodhisattvas are all going to gang up and surround this bodhisattva and go, "We're going to beat you up because one of your disciples went to hell." You know, I don't think it's like that. But what it's getting across to us is the point is that you know, bodhisattvas with these special abilities are definitely going to make those abilities readily available to others so that they can be of benefit to them. Okay, so they encourage people, they teach them appropriate practices, you know, they lead them in whatever way is possible. Okay, the verse 15, the next one, talks about the faults of deficient compassion. Okay. So, actually, you know, going back to this last one, it's kind of telling us, too, that, hey, you aspire to be a bodhisattva, and if you don't encourage others, and they get a bad rebirth, then, you know, your bodhisattva training is lacking. There's that kind of implicit message in verse 114. Verse 115, it's about the faults of deficient compassion. So Aryadeva says, "How can one unwilling to say that compassion for the oppressed is good later out of compassion give to the protectorless?" Okay, so this is a difficult verse, okay? So if a beginning bodhisattva, out of jealousy, is unwilling to admit that it's good to act compassionately towards other sentient beings who are oppressed with illness or poverty and its causes, how could that bodhisattva later, out of compassion, give his body, possessions, and roots of virtue to sentient beings? Now, the thing here is a bodhisattva out of jealousy be willing to, is unwilling to admit that it's good to act compassionately towards those oppressed with suffering. First of all, it's strange that a bodhisattva would be unwilling to say that it's good to help those oppressed by suffering. And why? Out of jealousy. You know? So it was reminding me of that other verse you asked about jealousy, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, if it, instead of jealousy, it's contempt. You know, if a bodhisattva has contempt for beings who are suffering, then how are they later going to change their mind and give their body possessions and root of virtue? Or another way, when I thought about it, another way, it's like if that, because this is talking about a beginning bodhisattva who are not as skilled, so maybe there's kind of imagining, Aryadeva's imagining, what if this beginning bodhisattva is jealous of the advanced bodhisattvas mm-hmm. who, you know, can actually be beneficial to those oppressed by suffering, whereas this beginning bodhisattva, because, you know, they don't have the same wisdom, compassion, and skillful means, is lacking that ability. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what the jealousy means. These are just some of my thoughts. It's not totally clear. Okay. Verse 116 talks about the faults of not appreciating bodhisattvas. So here Joe Blow is asking a good question. He says, what are the faults of hating a bodhisattva who is governed by compassion? Okay. So there's a bodhisattva governed by compassion, and you hate that person. Now, you know, when you think of it, maybe here is where in the previous verse where the jealousy comes in. We might look at somebody who is a very excellent practitioner, who's very kind, very subdued, can really reach out and connect with people. And us, I mean, we're not beginning bodhisattvas, we're ordinary beings, but we get jealous of that bodhisattva. Like, wow, everybody pays so much attention to them. So many people come when they teach, and not so many people come when I teach. Yeah? So, or, you know, they receive so many offerings, and, you know, people don't give me nearly as much offerings, and so get jealous in that kind of way. Okay? So, so somebody, when you think, you know, why would somebody hate a bodhisattva? Well, you can see, you know, when we have a lot of afflictions, we could very easily get jealous of somebody. Or if the bodhisattva's doing something that is for the benefit of a large group of people, but it actually interferes with what we want, but we're not thinking about what's beneficial for the large group. We're only thinking for ourselves, about ourselves. So then we get mad at what they're doing, not realizing how many people they're benefiting. Okay? Or maybe a bodhisattva is from a different culture. They act in a different way. Culturally, they may even have different values or different habits. And we think, oh, they're so rude, or they're so biased, or they're so this, or they're so that, you know, simply because they don't act like we want people to act, you know, because we are so attached to our culture that we just come in with the idea of the way I do things is the right way and the only way to do it, not realizing that other cultures have other values. Yeah, so then we could very easily get angry at a bodhisattva who was acting with the cultural values and, you know, connecting with other people. But, and we think, why are they acting that way? That's so ridiculous. Yeah. Like, you know, when you initially go to the Tibetan community, it's not so much like this now, but like when I first went. In Tibetan culture, and especially in old Tibet, when you saw something you liked, or a person you liked, you would stick out your tongue. Like that. And it's actually, I read somewhere, that it's actually to show that you don't have some kind of black magic spell or something that you're going to inflict on them. So you stick out your tongue. And that comes very automatically to, you know, the elderly Tibetans. The young ones don't do this now. But, you know, before they really used to do that. In our culture, what does sticking your tongue out mean? Mm. Yeah, it's like so rude, isn't it? Yeah, it's very insulting. So we could easily look at something like that and go, what kind of person is this sticking their tongue out? You know, how rude. Yeah. But of course, in Tibetan culture, and again, this is changing, clapping your hands is to chase away spirits. Yeah? So, they said when young husbandsmen in the, or like 1906, 08, whatever year it was, when he came into Lhasa, then all the Tibetans were lined up and they were all clapping. And he, being British, thought, oh, they're welcoming us. Not realizing that they were trying to chase away these devils. Okay. So you get these kind of different cultural things where we could easily judge somebody totally incorrectly. Okay. So, so the faults of not appreciating a bodhisattva, you know, because of our own critical, judgmental, jealous mind. Aryadeva says, when those indifferent towards one, indifferent, in other words, indifferent towards a bodhisattva, when those indifferent toward one who stays in the world, why it lasts, to help transmigrators, suffer loss, what doubt about those who are hostile? Okay. So when those people who... Okay, so you have a bodhisattva who stays in the world for as long as the world exists to help transmigrators. And somebody is indifferent towards that bodhisattva. Just, apathetic, like you were talking about. Okay? So if somebody is apathetic or indifferent towards a bodhisattva, they lose out, don't they? Yeah, because that bodhisattva, they have so much that they can teach that person, and the person can benefit so much from connecting with the bodhisattva. But if they're totally indifferent and uninterested, then they really lose out. So if that's the case for somebody who's apathetic, then needless to say, somebody who is hostile towards a bodhisattva really loses out. Okay? Because the person who's indifferent, maybe, you know, there's a chance you can get them interested some way. But somebody who's hostile is very, very difficult. Okay? So the sutras say that that kind of person will experience bad rebirths more than 100 times. Okay? Somebody who's hostile towards a bodhisattva. So therefore, it's proper, it's suitable to rid ourselves of animosity and jealousy towards bodhisattvas and instead to develop strong appreciation for them because they do what is most difficult, which is having the courage and the fortitude to hang in there and to benefit sentient beings. Okay, so while we lose out and on one hand create tremendous negative karma, because they say, when you're angry at a bodhisattva and then you interfere with their virtuous deeds, which are done for the benefit of all sentient beings, since we harm a bodhisattva's deeds, it's the same as interfering with the happiness of all sentient beings, because a bodhisattva is working for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's incredible negative karma. Okay? Nevertheless, even when we're mad at a bodhisattva, they say that it makes a karmic connection with them that will benefit us in the future. Because the bodhisattva, even though we may be looking at them like, they're looking at us and making prayers to be of benefit to us. Yeah? You know, when we dedicate the merit after lunch and we say, may all those, I can never remember...
Huh? Hit me, attack me with weapons, do things.
Right, hit me, attack me with weapons, and do things up to the point of killing me. May they all attain the happiness of awakening. That's what a bodhisattva is praying. You know, so somebody may be rude and have so much animosity, but this is what a bodhisattva is praying for them. Okay, so they say that it does benefit that sentient being. Of course, they have to somehow experience the ripening of their negative karma, but at least they've made a link to, you know, with that bodhisattva. Okay? So now maybe when we recite that line in prayers, kind of it'll mean a little bit more, and especially for us how to cultivate our mind. Yeah? And when you really think of it, you know, I mean, bodhisattvas are how easy is it to work for the benefit of sentient beings? And how easy is it to realize emptiness and perfect all the bodhisattva practices, you know? Not easy. So bodhisattvas really do what's most difficult. So, of course, it's much more suitable that we appreciate them. Isn't it? You know? Because actually, when a bodhisattva is successful, we're the ones who get benefited from it. Yeah? So similarly, you know, with our Dharma friends, kind of being jealous of our Dharma friends or competing with them is really harming us. You know, first of all, because we create so much negative karma through having ill will and, you know, critical words and so on and so forth. But also, it's really rather stupid because if that person is more advanced than us and they attain enlightenment first, because we have a connection with them, they'll come and help us.
Yeah? So why be jealous of our Dharma friends? It's like, sure, you're more advanced than me. I really rejoice because in the end of the day, we're the ones who's going to benefit from somebody being better than we are. Yeah? So this is another way in which our self-centered mind is so confused and sees the cause of happiness as suffering. Yeah? So really, you know, whenever some kind of jealousy comes up about, oh, that one person is a better meditator, that person understands the teaching better than I do, that person's closer to the teacher, they got to bring them tea and I didn't get to bring them tea, and, you know, all these kinds of things, instead of, again, with the jealousy and stuff, just say, wow, I'm glad somebody's practice is going so well, that's really good. Yeah? And if they're enlightened before me, fantastic! Yeah, I'm the one who benefits from that. I don't need to compete with my Dharma friends or get jealous of them. Yeah, I can, support them as they go forward. Okay, then verse 117 is about the suitability of cultivating appreciation for bodhisattvas, especially the deeds that are difficult to perform. Okay? So, verse 117 is talking about some of the qualities of the bodhisattvas so that we can develop some respect and appreciation for them. So, Aryadeva says, one who in all lives has the five super knowledges appears as inferior with a nature like the inferior. This is extremely hard to do. So what this means is, okay, a bodhisattva who has attained forbearance and the five super knowledges, which I'll describe in a minute, and these five super knowledges won't decline in all future lives, okay, because they're not just based on karma or based on samadhi, they're based on their realization of emptiness and their bodhicitta. Okay, so this kind of bodhisattva, in order to benefit sentient beings in inferior rebirths, may take on a body like those sentient beings and act like those sentient beings. Okay, so in order to benefit, let's say, insects, a bodhisattva may appear as a bee or a yellow jacket. Okay, or in order to benefit other turkeys, a bodhisattva may appear as a turkey. Yeah, or in order to benefit us, they may appear as a human being, or as a turkey, or as a bee. You know, we don't really know, okay? But the feat of maturing sentient beings, the ability to really ripen sentient beings is very difficult to do. And ripening sentient beings means teaching them how to create good karma, how to create merit, yeah, and then helping that merit to kind of come together and ripen so that that sentient being's mind is receptive. Okay, so ripening sentient beings' minds actually means making them receptive to the Dharma. Okay, now how easy is it to make sentient beings receptive to the Dharma? Okay, we all have families. We've talked to our families about the Dharma. How easy has it been for our families to understand the Dharma and for us to make them receptive to the Dharma? Not so easy, is it? Yeah, not so easy. So bodhisattvas have ways of manifesting, you know, in ways that are really beyond our conception, to be able somehow to open sentient beings' minds even a little bit, to be able to, you know, be a little bit receptive to the Dharma. And then in that life, you know, then the next life, appearing again and working with that sentient being's karma, teaching them how to create merit and virtue, and then helping them to become more receptive then. Okay? So, you know, I often think that in a previous life I might have been a flea in my teacher's shemdop, and, you know, they happened to find me and instead of squishing me did a bunch of mantras and then prayed for me to become one of their disciples in the future. Very possible. You know, I had a friend in San Francisco who had cockroaches galore in her flat. This was many years ago. And she used to pray for them to become her disciples in future lives. And that's the way we relate to the turkeys. You know, all those turkeys that she feeds, you know, you're doing the remember the first way of gathering disciples, being generous? So she's giving them cracked corn all winter long. They love her. They come flying from all directions when they see her coming. Yeah. So in some future lifetime, those turkeys will probably be your disciples. Okay? And hopefully they'll be a little smarter then. Yeah?
Oh, I'm in big trouble.
Yeah. And we take our kitties and we walk them around the, you know, the stupa, not the stupa, but the Buddha statue in the garden. And, you know, and we make prayers to be able to benefit them. We're planting good seeds in their mind. We're helping to make them, receptive. We bring them in here to the teachings. Are they in here listening? Yeah? Okay. But she can hear in there, can't she? Yeah? Yeah. So, we try and do what we can. When I lived in India, Lama Zopa had these Lhasa Apso dogs. Lhasa Apso. Mm-hmm. You know, Tibetans love those little dogs. So, there was one nun who was in charge of the dogs, and she was instructed, she was giving a whole series of initiations. These dogs came to all the initiations. And then in the evening, some of us would go out there and we would chant with the dogs. Chant to the dogs, I should say. Yeah? <Say that. laughs> Yeah. You know how you translate Om Mani Padme Hum into dog language. Okay. So, oh, does anybody have the book with them? There were a few very sweet stories that I thought I would read to you. That so you get an idea of kind of the traditional literature and the kind of examples that it gives. Oh, you even had the page marked. Okay, so let me read you these stories that illustrate how these bodhisattvas can manifest. And do what's very difficult and ripen people who are very close-minded. Okay, so there was a dog, and as soon as he was born, he looked for a lonely place to live and always stayed at the edge of the wilderness with the other dogs. One day, the dogs ate the leather cover of the king's favorite chariot. You know, of your mother's sofa. Okay. The king was furious and ordered all the dogs to be rounded up and killed. Without being seen by anyone, the bodhisattva, who's manifested as a dog, crept under the king's lion throne, which was set in the center of his court. But the king caught sight of him and declared, "The one that ate the leather cover of the king's horse chariot is here. Now that you're here, we will not let you go." To this, the bodhisattva replied, "If I fail to dissuade you, of course I should be punished." "How can you do anything but fail when you ate the leather cover?" said the king. And the bodhisattva replied, It's the palace attendant's fault. This part I don't think a bodhisattva would really say, but anyway. You know, a bodhisattva would shove the blame to somebody else. But anyway, he says it's the palace attendant's fault. Animals don't know what they should and shouldn't eat. For a start, even if I did eat it myself, the guards are still in the wrong and not me. In that case, how can all the dogs living in the district, this town, and this country be guilty? Yeah. If one ate it, all of them didn't do it. The king's order that they should all be punished is therefore unjust. In other words, king, you are racist and speciesist and bigot. Yeah? Okay. Do human beings receive the same treatment? I think not. And if they don't, it is ridiculously unfair, the dog said to the king. The king was moved and delighted by these amazing human words. He prevented the dogs from being harmed and became involved in religious practice. Okay, so a bodhisattva's skillful means to benefit the king. Okay, second story. When a king, hopefully a different one, was abroad, he stayed with a serving woman who bore him a child. The other children said to the child, "Serving woman's brat, be off. You don't even know whose son you are." So the child went to his mother, and when he asked who had fathered him, she said it was the king. Okay, this was John Edwards and his South American mistress and everything. Anyway, okay, she said it was the king, okay. And the child said to her, "Offer me to the king and tell him to accept his son." She replied that the king would not accept him and that she would be beaten. So the child began to cry, and his longing pained her heart. So she went to see the king, who was surrounded by his courtiers, is that how you say it? Yeah, and pointed to her son, but the king looked the other way. Okay, urged on by the child, she walked over to the other side, but when she showed him the boy, the king just did the same thing again, looked the other way. The boy told his mother, "Why are you gesturing? Speak to him." Because of her son's misery, she spoke to the king in a loud voice, "Your Highness, recognize your son. Till now I have brought him up." The king was embarrassed and ordered his men to beat the serving woman, who he said was a liar. Okay. As they approached her with whips in their hands, the bodhisattva, the little boy, like the king of geese, spread his wings, flew up from his mother's lap, and hovering in the sky, asked the king, "Are you not pleased that I am the king's son?" The king, with tearful eyes and goosebumps, rose from his golden throne and stretched out his arms and said in a barely audible voice, "Please come down, holy being. If you take care of Indra, the king of gods, my son, surely you must take care of such as me." Mm-hmm. Having said this, he made offerings to the child and to the mother as was befitting. Mm-hmm. Okay? So kind of amazing ways of benefiting others. Yeah, but a bodhisattva who has these five clairvoyant powers knows the different ways to do, you know, they can see the karma that they have with different disciples. They can see what karma in the disciples is ready to manifest. And so they you know, the higher level bodhisattvas, not the low level bodhisattvas, but the higher level bodhisattvas who have the five super knowledges, they know all of this, and also because of after the path of seeing and above, when the bodhisattvas have the ability to reappear in any kind of rebirth they want to, then they can do that for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay. So I'll go through the five super knowledges next time. Okay. Got questions or comments?
In this last instance, does this help that being received from bodhisattvas depend on having made any kind of prayers in previous lives? Or, you know, out of ignorance, at some point we wouldn't have known to make prayers?
Yeah. So you're asking if, like, one of these kings made prayers in a previous life to be benefited by a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. It's quite possible. You know, they very well might have. Or they might have been somebody who was very arrogant or angry in front of a bodhisattva, but the bodhisattva made prayers to be able to benefit them in a future life. Clearly that king had some bit of virtue somewhere along the line, maybe from going around the stupa, or maybe from hearing teachings, or something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The generosity, is that only related to material possessions or giving?
No, it's also related to other forms of giving. Mm-hmm. Because although giving material possessions is a very common way in every single culture, mm-hmm. to express fondness, to express connection with somebody. But it doesn't mean that you have to have a lot of wealth to make connections with sentient beings. Very often what people need the most is a smile, or they need a little bit of encouragement, or a little bit of appreciation, or a little bit of help doing something, one thing or another. So our generosity can also be of other things as well.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that since we don't know who bodhisattvas are, if mm-hmm. we keep that in mind, then try to relate to everybody with compassion, and then just by doing those actions, then we can develop ourselves into bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Okay. So you're thinking, since we don't know who's a bodhisattva and who's not, by treating everybody with compassion, by respecting everybody, mm-hmm. Not looking down on people, not being contemptful or judgmental, mm-hmm. then that can help us become like a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite definitely. Now, I remember one time, because I had a little bit of trouble with this when I first heard, you know, since you don't know who's a bodhisattva and who isn't, you shouldn't criticize anybody. And I thought, but what if somebody's doing something really damaging and really harmful? That means that you don't point it out, you just say, oh, it's a bodhisattva? Is that what it means? You know, use some kind of racist person who's really damaging a lot of sentient beings, and you say, oh, well, maybe they're a bodhisattva, so you don't say anything about their racist views or try and change things that aren't going well, you know? Maybe all these people, I mean, in Egypt now there's total chaos. Yeah, so maybe you say, okay, all these people killing each other, maybe they're all bodhisattvas, so I don't want to interfere with the bodhisattva's action, and I don't want to criticize anybody. Is that what it means? It can't mean that, can it? It can't mean that. Yeah. But I was very confused about these kinds of things, and so, you know, I was asking my teachers about it. And then I also had to really think a lot about it myself. Like, what could this possibly mean? Because clearly, you know, if you're a bodhisattva and you have compassion, you're going to intervene when somebody's going to get harmed. And you're not just going to say, oh, somebody's beating somebody else up, but, you know, they're Yamantaka who's beating up Hayagriva, so I'm not going to break up their fight. Mm. You know, that's nuts. So one thing, I think, is to be able to separate the person from the action And to say that action is unsuitable, the action is damaging, but without criticizing the person. That way you're not criticizing the bodhisattva. Okay? And it's a way, I think, of like showing us that you can intervene when there's harm or when something inappropriate is going on. You can intervene without being angry. I think that's what this whole thing is aimed at teaching us. Not that you're passive and say, oh, well, they're all bodhisattvas, so I don't need to do anything. But you say, you know, whether they're bodhisattvas or not, this situation to common appearance is harmful, and I have to intervene. But just in case they're bodhisattvas, I'm not going to be angry at the people doing these actions. And even if they aren't bodhisattvas, I'm going to have a much better effect if I'm not angry at them when I intervene. Okay? So I think that's what it's getting us to. Okay? Not just whitewashing everything. You know? But there's so much misunderstanding, I think, in the West about these kinds of techniques, you know, because they're just said in the teachings, but you don't always get everything unpacked, that people can get pretty confused. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Especially if you're told, see, everybody is a deity. Okay? So, you know, so I don't know, you know, they just convicted this one Boston big mafia boss. You know, I can't remember his name, but anyway, to say, well, maybe he's just Chen Resi in that form. So, you know, don't arrest him. Yeah, don't prosecute him for 19 murders. He's Chen Resi. That's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, even if he is appearing as, even if he is Chen Resi appearing in that way as a way to subdue sentient beings' minds, still, we have to point out that action, we're dealing with conventional reality here, that action is, you know, unsuitable and people shouldn't be doing it and something needs to be done. But we do that without being angry. Yeah.
See, I really don't understand that, how they can be appearing in that way and do those actions.
It's very difficult to understand. Right. I mean, I can't pretend to understand either how a bodhisattva could appear as, you know, somebody in that way. The only thing I can relate it to is that story they tell about, you know, the bodhisattva who was the captain of the ship. So in that way, okay.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's quite difficult. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
The same concern raised, as you're aware, in Singapore too, where people feel uncomfortable giving feedback to the Sangha because they feel, oh, if I say anything bad, I will go to hell, you know. So they feel stuck that way. Then there's this weird relationship between the Sangha and the
Sangha.
So how would you?
Yeah, okay. So sometimes a similar kind of dynamic happens in terms of seeing a Sangha member act inappropriately. And this, you were saying that lay people don't want to comment on it, but also sometimes other Sangha members don't want to comment on it. You know, somebody's acting inappropriately and you think, but, you know, they're senior, they're a very respected person, or if you're a lay person, they're a Sangha member, I'm going to create so much negative karma by criticizing them. Actually, the Buddha, you know, while it is true that if you criticize the Sangha with a negative, disrespectful mind, you create negative karma. Okay, so if you have a really rotten attitude and disrespectful mind, it is true that you create negative karma criticizing the Sangha, even if you yourself are a Sangha member criticizing. However, you know, when you look in the Vinaya, so many of our precepts were made because the lay people complained about how Sangha members were acting. Yeah. And the Buddha said, you know, if somebody is not behaving properly, you know, you don't have to show them respect. Yeah, you may show respect to the robes, but you don't have to show respect to that person. Mm. Yeah. So it's there. You know, there's nothing that saying you again that you have to whitewash, because in actual fact, it's often when the lay people say something that then, you know, people start keeping their precepts better, or the lay people, you know, also when they stop supporting, if there's somebody who isn't behaving appropriately, like in Thailand, then they just don't give that person dana. Yeah, it's a good way to get across the point that, hey, you're not behaving properly. Yeah. So, you know, if a Sangha member is doing something that's not very good, you know, the way to deal with it isn't to, you know, in front of the whole community say, I saw you at a restaurant with a woman alone. What are you doing there, doing that? You know, saying that in front of, you know, 50 or 100 people. That's not the skillful way. Yeah? Okay? Nor is it skillful to go gossip behind everybody's back. Yeah? But you might write, you know, if you're too shy to say it directly because you feel that would be disrespectful, then write an anonymous letter, you know, and just say, I saw you doing da-da-da-da-da, I was concerned about your benefit, you know, and express it as a letter of concern, something like that, yeah? Or write to that person's teacher, yeah? And ask the teacher, please, you know, speak to that their disciple about it, what's happening. Yeah. I mean, I know a situation of one Sangha member who was not behaving very well, and somebody filed a court suit, you know, a suit in court about it. And, you know, it was a big deal, but it kind of, I think, this person got the message that they can't continue to act that way.
It's a little bit odd, but as a Sangha member of a community, how can you kind of purify towards a lay community? What is the official way to do that?
You mean as a Sangha member, if you...
Yeah.
Misbehave to purify to the lay community.
Yeah, so that's because it's so difficult to let it go, probably for people.
Yeah, you know, one of the things in the Vinaya is if a Sangha member has offended a lay person, then the Sangha does a transaction, a Sangha karma, that requires that person to go to the lay person's house and apologize. And they may send another monk or nun together with that person to kind of be there and encourage them and encourage the layperson to accept the apology. Yeah. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions and especially Atravastiya be in the west floor.